Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome on back to the 40K segment of the Wide World of Wargaming. As always, I am your host, Vincent Borgato. Joining me, as per the usual, Mr. Alexander Gonzalez.
Hi, everyone.
And joining us from the great state of Oregon, our old friend of the show and one of the hosts of the old T-Shift tournament for some of the OGs in the audience, Mr. Ben Schwoller.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Thank you very much for joining us, sir, and making your inaugural appearance. It is always nice to have another scholar and a gentleman guard player on the show.
Well, to be full disclosure, I only own like 30 more guardsmen. I sold almost everything else. Pretty much I'm just pure custodes now. Gold janitors, baby.
I am regretting our choice of guest on the... No, I'm kidding. We are going to be talking about Alex and Ben's little adventure at a Guardians Games RTT, and then we are going to dig into some of the updates for the upcoming SoCal Open and a few official updates from GW. There were a lot of rules changes, a lot of wailing, gnashing of teeth, and screaming, and as, of course, we do love drama on this show, we will dig into all of that. But, as we said, you guys had a little adventure this weekend. Finishing 6th and 7th at this RTT, respectively, Ben and then Alex. Ben, you finished ahead, so I'm going to ask you, break us down your three games and what you brought.
Yeah, so I have a heavy Forge World heavy for Custodes battalion. It's got Trajan, Captain General Trajan. I had a Shield Captain on a Dawn Eagle jet bike with bolters. And then I had three units of three Sagittarian Guard with Mystic Cordios as my troops. I had a Vexilla Praetor with a -1 to hit banner. We gave him the axe, and we also made him the Warlord, gave him the relic that gave him a 3+ invulnerable. I also gave the jet bike captain the 3+ invul reroll charges relic. And then I took one more shield captain on foot with a sword and board, storm shield and sword, to do the spirit detachment, where I put in two Caladius tanks and a Telamon Dreadnought with a storm cannon and two storm cannons and their missile rack. So rounded out to be 9 command points, spending one right at the beginning. And sometimes if I thought I needed it, I'd spend two to get Victor of the Blood Games, either on the Dawn Eagle, shield captain, or Trajan. So that's kind of the list. Its strengths and weaknesses are obviously a lot of firepower. Despite the nerfs down to the Caladius, I think it's an excellent tank still, and it's just turned into something that's very reasonable. The fire number of shots is just ludicrous. The Telamon Dreadnought, the Storm Cannons are definitely the way to go. I'm debating on trying it out with instead just a Storm Cannon and a Fist instead of two Storm Cannons. I'm not sure yet. It would be nice to let it have some punch if it gets stuck in melee, which happened on my first game and definitely was a problem. But the Sagittarian Guard, if you're trying to play Custodes competitively and not bringing Sagittarian Guard, you are really messing up. You are not maximizing all the options at your disposal because the amount of firepower they put out is insane. They're very mobile. They're insanely durable. And when each one has four Misericordia attacks and they're rerolling ones because they're by Trajan, they put out some serious hurt. So it's really strong in those senses. But the bigger issue is it's very consolidated. I try to keep everybody close to the banner to help protect them and get the buffs from Trajan or the shield captain. So it's really hard for me to reach out and grab something unless the whole army moves up as a block. And so when I come across super aggressive armies, which is what happened all three of my games, I'm kind of forced to turtle up in a corner and concede score more every turn to my opponents. But I almost always get kill more. And if I'm not getting kill more, that usually is a bad sign for me. And if I'm getting hold more, that's a very good sign for me.
Yeah. Probably by the time you're getting hold more in a game, the other guy pretty much doesn't have a lot left.
Yeah, that's the case. Every orc army I've played, I've almost tabled. Usually end up killing.
Wow.
And we're talking like green tides here, like 3 to 4 units of 30 boys with, you know, all the characters, big blocks of Ludas, tons of Gretchen. Most of the time, if I don't table them, they only get away with like 3 or 4 characters and maybe a Grot squad. So the amount of firepower is ridiculous. I had one game where I killed almost 100 orcs. I was over 100 orcs in the first two turns. So the firepower is just ludicrous. And the combat power is still really good because they come running in thinking, you know, if they tie me up, I don't have the guns. But the tanks fly away. The characters and Sagittarian Guard cut their way out, and they start unloading on stuff again. The big problem, though, is definitely board control. And if there's something that can get in mobile enough and tie me up and not let me shoot them and has my shooting bounce off them, I'm really in trouble, which is what happened in my first game. I definitely made some deployment mistakes against a Gene Stealer Cult. And I had not played Gene Stealer Cult actually at all in 8th. My meta around here is pretty much heavily Imperium and Chaos. And so yeah. I really felt the pain for sure. Those Aberrants all buffed up are awesome. He vected away my Tanglefoot Grenade. I couldn't block any of his psychic powers with my stratagem. It was unfortunate that not only did, you know, I not deploy as well as I should have maybe, but he knew Custodes really well because one of his best friends played Custodes. And he just outplayed me, got everything he needed to do. It was super frustrating that I got the Swarm Lord down to one wound and like was charging him with shield captains and firing Palis grav tanks at him. And just was bouncing off of them. Oh, yes. I forgot. My list does also have two Palis Graf tanks, which are unbelievable steal for 100 points a pop. They are amazing.
There's not a lot bad in Custodes, is there? Well, I mean, they're pretty much across the board.
I'm a big believer in a lot of the Forge World units. Some of them are definitely weaker than others. I'm not sold yet on the jump pack guys. But I do like even the Forge World jet bikes. They're a bit pricey, and there's better anti-tank options. The problem with a lot of like the straight book Custodes units is you need firepower in 8th. And if you walk across the table, unless you have good terrain, you're just going to get shot off the board. So that's like, I mean, my problem with jet, every time I go back to trying to use primarily Codex units, I'm like, yeah, this is why I don't bring these, because they just die before they earn their points. And it's not the same way with the Forge World units, which is a bummer. But it's just nice. At least they have tools for sure. The second game went a lot better for me. I did, funnily enough, face Gene Stealer Tyranid combo again. I seized the initiative on him and proceeded to kill like all his Zoanthropes. His army was designed to have a bunch of smite spam in it and then had a big block of Bulgrins they was going to buff up and hold the middle. You know, he got really discouraged on the seas, which I totally get because I was feeling a little discouraged in my first game when, you know, my opponent got his charges off, double activations, killed two Caladius, and locked up a Sagittarian unit. I tried to claw back in that game and didn't go well. So, and he was kind of in that same uphill battle. I really think he wasn't aggressive enough with me. If you can do the threat overload and really jam it down my throat and I can't stop that, that's how my army gets beaten. That's how Brandon Grant beat it. It's how the first Gene Stealer Cult guy beat me. It's how my wife beat me once with her knights. And so, but the issue is, you know, especially against knights, if you can pop off one or two that first turn, they won't have the numbers to grind you up and tie you up. So I cleared him off the board because he kind of came at me two piecemeal and secured a significant win. In the third game, played a really nice guy with orcs who was not like a new guy, but new to the tournament scene. And unfortunately for him, it was a pretty open terrain and pretty centralized objectives, which helps me out. I don't think he played quite as aggressively as he could have or should have. But the downside is, like, turn one, I opened up and killed a whole mob of 30 boys. I killed 50, like, of his models turn one. And I think, you know, that kind of caught him surprise. Turn one, he did kill one of my Caladiuses and then one of the Palises. And then the next turn, I killed, like, 60 orcs. I had a shield captain slingshot up the flank and rip apart the Luda unit. Although he did jump a tank buster unit, had to shoot twice, which is pretty scary, and cracked open my other Caladius, so the Teleman had to turn around and kill those. You know, orcs have a lot of good tools. The problem for orcs is they just don't have any staying power, which
yeah.
is good in a balanced perspective if you're bringing like 150 models, but if you're losing like a quarter of them every turn, that's not that great. And he wasn't doing the damage output he needed, especially because he's supposed to do so much damage in combat. And I think when he charged three Sagittarian Guard with a unit of 30 boys, I think I took two wounds, and they ended up killing like 10 orcs. So it's just not a great matchup for him in that sense. So, and then when you throw in the characters in that melee and they're just slicing and dicing, he had a great attitude about the whole thing. Went on to table him at turn four, I think. It might have been five. I think it was four, though. And, he just asked for opinions at the end, and I just said, don't fight Forge World shooting custodes on an open table, which is just a bummer. I mean, the terrain, not to say, was, like, super bad. It was just unique, and it's amazing how much terrain Guardian does have for the amount of tables they have in there. Blows away most game stores. So it's not to bag on it in that sense, but it's just tough. In 8th edition, you need so much terrain. And so the deployment map was rough for him because it was long across the board, and I could just kind of turtle up and let him come at me. It had been like half of the other options that are like the hammer and anvil style, the table probably would have been really great for him in terms of terrain hiding wise. But he has that long approach. So anyways, I ended up 2-3, two big wins, one huge loss, a lot of fun. Definitely am still very rusty with 40K. Not the seventh ed player I once was, but I really like
it. I know how that feels.
Yeah. And I've been playing a lot of Age of Sigmar, so there were a lot of moments where I'm like, I can totally do this. And I'm like, all right, nope, can't do that. It's a super fun game now, and I think you kind of just got to approach it with the right sense of you're playing a very, very, very shooting-dominant game. Melee is super powerful, and you can do a lot of trapping and shutting down shooting powers, but it's just more than ever. It's a shooting game, and if there aren't huge blocks of terrain in the middle, especially as a shooting army, I just think it's a super weak game, unfortunately.
How do you feel about this push coming out of certain people for entirely standardized terrain setups? I know Reese has started making mention of it, I think a couple other people have made it, kind of a priority that they want to make this a reality moving forward. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So actually, something we've been working really hard at Cascadia Championship, also formerly T-Shift, formerly T-Shift. We still run the event. Actually, we had a lot of fun at it. We had about 140K players and about 30 Age of Sigmar players at our event in August. We're working on terrain in a box. And one issue that we've had is the logistics of moving all this terrain, because I'm in Central Oregon and the rest of our crew is up in Canada, and we run an event in the Seattle area. It's a huge pain in the butt to get terrain for, 130 players up to that area from two different areas. And so what we've been working on is a very standardized-esque style where there's one larger ruin and a bunch of ruins break down into it. And it's funny because people have been trying to do this in other threads. I've seen that one photo that's floating around competitive 40K of this one guy saying I can do this, and it's good functional terrain. The huge upside for a TO is that we got two 40K tables fit in a banker's box. I mean, that's just crazy space saving. It could be a little bigger maybe. We also are dealing with some of the logistic realities. It's tough. I think if you can pull it off to where it's good functional terrain that looks good, I think it's a great thing. Just I'm the logistic TO bias. You know, when I'm coming to a tournament, I want stuff to look nice, and there should be effort put into the presentation. And I think that can be done with standardized train because you laser etch new designs in it, whatever, paint the colors up to match like fat matte, flat or frontline matte themes and whatever. You know, I think there's abilities to spruce them up and then maybe take your top 10 tables and put some variety, nice, like, you know, maybe more frontline or Games Workshop terrain pieces more on those and have some of that stuff scattered around your standardized terrain. So to answer your question, as a TO, I don't mind it. I can understand from the player's perspective how it can get boring to play on. I do like to see variety, but when you have these, a lot of events that are bigger trying to run this, you know, as a favor or support to the community, you got to kind of balance their needs with the community's needs, right? And I guess, you know, if you're a TO and your players flipping hate it, they'll make it clear to you, and they'll have to pack it in and put it away. But I think there's some really awesome traveling and storage opportunities that are a huge cost saver potentially. And it's kind of fun, you know, to have this little battlefield in the box that packs up easily. I mean, this is not a space convenience hobby for sure. I mean, you
can
have a nice terrain set at home now, you know, in this little box and have it up on the shelf, roll up your fat mat, roll it out, drop some terrain. And then, you know, you're playing with like terrain that you're going to see at the event, right? That's always the gamble. Like, okay, let's do tournament prep. Well, what's the terrain going to be like? I don't know. We're going to try a game with thick terrain and a game with empty terrain. So I think in that sense, it's nice for tournament prep. It's got its strengths and weaknesses, but at the end of the day, I'm cautiously optimistic with it. I think it could be good for the hobby. And I think there's a way to standardize styles of terrains while still having variations. You could have four templates and, you know, that's some nice variation across a few tables here and there. So I think, you know, you're always going to find something to complain about, but as long as it meets good functionality, it can be a good thing.
My concern with standardized terrain is I have a couple of them. Number one, all terrain does not affect all deployments equally, and all terrain does not affect all missions equally. So unless you're, it almost feels like you would have to reshuffle terrain. You know, if you were to standardize it, you'd have to reshuffle the terrain every game. Which, if you're running a certain number of set pieces that you've tested out over a certain amount of time, then that's certainly doable. You know, you tell your players, hey, this is the, it basically goes in the rules packet, right? You say, here's where the objectives go. Here's where you move your terrain pieces to. This is how we feel that this terrain should be set up on this objective to give the most of, you know, the best experience for all involved. Now, of course, you do worry about that getting kind of stale, and you do worry about people finding ways to cheese that. But, you know, it's gaming. People are going to find ways to abuse everything in every situation ever.
Really, I did find
that's
that interesting.
What we do. That's why
like
we
that
exist.
That idea of a terrain reformat, a packet, if you standardize that, I definitely could see that being worthy of consideration and trial at an event. I don't know, maybe we'll try that at the next Cascadia Championship.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that you wouldn't think about it until you actually really dug into how easy it would be. Sorry, my voice is going. I too am battling a little something in my throat. I completely lost my train of thought. I'm abandoning that and we're moving on.
It's okay.
Alex, you two were at the same event, as I said, coming in seventh place. What went wrong? What went right? Jesus, there's a tongue twister that I did not expect when I started saying it. Talk to us, brother.
Yeah, well, not only was I a player in the tournament, but I was actually one of the TOs. So, you know,
so a lot of calls went your way, is what you're saying?
No, not at all. No. You know, with between myself,
that would never happen, right, Ben?
And my friend who was helping organize, and of course, having been there with all of his TO experience, you know, for the most part, a lot of the players at Guardian, you know, and in the Portland area in general, they're very experienced players. So there's never really an issue that requires a TO all that often, or at least more often than not. There's no need. So, you know, Ben came up and we played a practice game the day before with his custodes. He castled in, and I shouldn't have taken the bait, but I did.
Yeah, he munched you.
Well, here's the thing. The thing was, I was just thinking, oh man, custodes sure are scary in combat. I shouldn't get close to him. I shouldn't charge him at all. So I didn't charge him, and so I died. And if I charged him, I think it may have been a different game. You know, it's weird, you know, because his list isn't the one that's super scary in close combat outside of the shield captain. It's really just, you know, just one guy. So, or just one captain, and then, you know, everything else is a tank, you know. So it is, it's an interesting list. I think it's very useful. I think it's very strong, that custodes army, and, you know, they got a lot of tools in the toolbox, of course. At the tournament itself, did go 2-1. You know, did have one loss, as mentioned earlier. It was an interesting spread. There were a lot of different players there and a lot of different types of armies. Round one, what I brought was my Chaos Knight army, the one I've been building up for a while. It was Chaos Knight Lance, Iconoclast Household. So if I get charged, make a charge, perform a heroic intervention, I get +1 attack. But it was a Knight Lance or a Traitorous Lance, you know, made up of a double Gatling cannon despoiler, a gallant style despoiler, so sword and fist. And then I also had a double thermal cannon despoiler with an Iron Storm rocket pod. The gallant style was a Dreadblade, so he could roll on the Pax and Damnation table. Then I also had a super heavy detachment. Super heavy detachment was a character in the super heavy detachment that was a Knight Castigator, who was also a Dreadblade. He also had the Runes of Noctega, and that is a Dreadblade only relic, gives 5 of them close combat too, and you get to choose one more Pact and Damnation. So essentially, he had one chosen and one rolled for bad thing, and then 2 rolled for and 1 chosen good thing, good, you know, benefit for the game. So had him and then 2 Moirax Armigers, both with Moirax Siege Claws with attached Rad Cleansers and Lightning Locks. So that was my army, and round one went up against a guy who brought Sisters of Battle, the Rusty 17, and a Crassed Gallant. The Sisters of Battle, there were a bunch of Battle Sisters, 2 units of Seraphim, a couple of rando characters, but they did include Celestine and a Sister Superior, and then 3 Exorcists. So from the get-go, I was like, oh boy, here we go, Exorcists. But it was almost a complete wash. I mean, I lost one of my knights to a gallant, the Crass Gallant, which Crass Gallants like to do. But besides that, it was just total wash. Second game was against a Swarm Orc player. You know, he brought 120 boys. He brought 2 max units of Tank Bustas. He brought, the soon to be gone, you know, Index, mech on a bike and a war boss on a bike and a pain boy and 2 weird boys. And so he had a lot of stuff going on. He may have played a little more reserved than he should have. So, another tabling there. But then I fought against, a good local, named Harry, and he brought his salamanders and, you know, new Space Marines, new book. He did very well against me, kind of melted it up, and you know, was able to just completely wreck me on game 3.
So, and that's I'm going to try to spell to pronounce this. Is it Gieringer?
Yeah.
And that's the gentleman who ended up winning the event, so I guess you were playing top table, huh?
We were. Yeah, we were playing for all the marbles. But, I mean, there were a lot of things that went on at this tournament that I thought was really interesting. There were a lot of interesting situations that occurred. One of my favorites, we talked about just before the start of this episode, up-and-comer, Tanner, a local from the Portland area, he was going up against another local, Ryan, and it was Iron Hands versus Mixed Chaos. And, the Iron Hands list was a little, let's call it unconventional. It wasn't three repulsors, but instead it was, it was, a captain, Iron Father Ferios, of course, a few units of tactical marines, two ironclad dreadnoughts, two individual land raiders that were Godhammer pattern. He then also had another Iron Hands battalion, so two battalions, with a Primaris chaplain, a Primaris librarian, min units of scouts, big units of space marines, and that was it. So he had he basically had Ferios and a lieutenant wrapped around the two ironclad dreadnoughts, as well as the two Godhammer pattern land raiders. And, Tanner brought Lord Discordant, some 1,000 Sons Supreme Command Detachment. You know where this is going.
I've never heard of this before.
Yeah. But then he also brought Mortarion. And, Mortarion died in Overwatch against the two, against the front line with Ferios.
Man, it's almost like
let me give you that more perspective. Mortarion was fully good to go. He was fully wounded and he died in Overwatch.
Yeah, it's almost
I feel Ferios like he's pretty steep really, for 110 really points. It's a toss-up.
Yeah, he's that's a really, really overall balanced character, I think.
For you sound like someone I know.
For 110.
Okay,
for
cool. I'm not the only one who heard that. Okay,
cool. I'm just gonna leave that there. That he's very, very balanced. I wanna ask you guys about kind of a couple of your matchups and how you feel about them. Ben, pure custodes, that's a high wire act. As you said, it is a very heavy damage output list, but also if somebody does properly engage you, they can kind of they can reduce your overall output fairly quickly. How do you manage it? How do you manage such a low command point army and in terms of managing that resource in this meta? And then what would you say is your worst matchup?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's a lot more command points than it originally was. When I was first playing with this list, the Sagittarian Guard were heavy supports. Yeah, and they were only – I only have 4 command points. So.
Oh, my God.
And I was doing really well with it. At Boise Cup, my only loss was Brandon Grant.
Yeah, it's a good loss.
And then at Storm I had a loss to Mason Moore, and we had a great game. It was super fun, but my dice were a little funky. And the Harvester has very unique style missions on every table, and I definitely I built my list much more thinking about ITC style missions, and it showed when I was looking at the mission packets. I either was like, this is going to be super easy, or this is going to be super terrible. And it was often the latter because it was like, hold all these points. And I'm like, that's not going to happen. So
hold 6 objectives, but I only have 5 units.
I think what it comes down to is I really only spend my command points on a few things. Tanglefoot grenades, which are like the godsend of that codex and that list.
An old friend of the show once called them the best stratagem in 40K.
Yeah, I think they might be. They're certainly underpriced at 1 point. They probably should be 2 points. The other really good ones that I use are the
On the Sagittarian Guard, if you deep strike within 12 inches, a Custodes infantry unit can shoot at them, which can be very good if it's a Sagittarian unit. And then that one gets used less often, but can be very helpful. The other one can be interruptions, just to kind of save a unit in a fight or take the edge off a big mob. So my bad matchups tend to be super, super aggressive melee things or that are very fast. Knight melee armies are very tough. The other tough ones are high ballistic skill, high damage shooting armies.
Eldar,
I actually have yet to fight Eldar somehow, but Admech I've found can be a very, very tough matchup.
Especially with that mortal wound generation when you don't have that many wounds to give.
That's definitely the big problem for the Custodes is if they're running into mortal wound spam, that can be a disaster. So if I run into a psychic heavy army, I have little to no psychic defense. I have one stratagem to roll a deny the witch. It's not even like a 4-up guarantee pass or something. So that can be really rough. And then a 6-up feel no pain on the infantry against mortal wounds. It's just not enough. So my opponent, like Thousand Sun, can be a tough matchup if I don't wax those psychers super quick. Which I've done well against. I don't actually think I've lost yet to Thousand Sons, and I've played a couple different armies, or siege armies, but they always feel like a balancing act for sure. Apparently, Gene Stiller Cult definitely can be a problem, although I think I won't make the same deployment mistakes against them again. It's kind of these armies that are balance, try to jack of all trades it. I actually think Custodes are going to be in a really good spot and do well against Space Marines. There's going to be some lists that they struggle against and situationally, but I think given Misericordias on Sagittarium, I can handle most things I bump into in melee when they're backed up by the characters and the firepower to chew away the really scary things on the way over. So I think given the explosion of Space Marines, they'll do well there. One thing I found that they have a hard time with is the Tau. They just have a really hard time getting to the drones. The only upside is the amount of firepower those Caladius tanks have. They pass off so many that you end up killing the drones relatively quickly.
Yeah.
But that can still – that's never how you want to be killing drones. But you know, I think they're in a strong spot. I just need to practice and play more 40K because I'm sure there's lots of moments where a better general could have corrected the mistakes I made by just understanding and knowing all the other codices better. Like I said, I really only play kind of the same few armies, lots of Chaos Space Marine or Chaos Armies, a lot of Admech and Space Marines and Tau. So it's a very kind of mono template, but from what I fought overall, I feel like it's a very strong list. I have an overall winning record. Guard are very swingy. I either table them or they tabled me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I would say. If there's missions, picking the secondaries are important and what they pick against me. If I'm trying to pick board control secondaries, it's terrible. And if I'm fighting against armies that are really good at not giving up secondaries, it's very, very tough for me.
So no ground control behind enemy lines recon for you is what you're saying?
I don't even like those ones usually to begin with. So it's I know there's some armies that are really great at them, but it doesn't usually fit my playstyle, and definitely not this army list.
I'm going to throw this one up for both of you, and then, Alex, I'm going to ask about your knights just because you were very, very excited about them when they showed up. How do you guys feel about the guy who included Bulgrins with his Gene Stealer cult? I love that combo.
I think it's a great combo. I think he didn't use it to its full potential. I
would agree just based on what I heard. Like, you would think that list would – because Bulgrins are already one of the best units in 40K. With the proper buffs, they just run over everything and they eat shooting like you might, like you're throwing rocks at them.
Yeah,
Well, right, and Ben mentioned that he doesn't have psychic defense, so he doesn't really have a way to stop him.
Yeah, well, because the guy did have a psyker and a priest with him, so he had the proper buffs ready to go. I think I'm not sure if I just took him aback, but I think they have a very strong place in the Gene Still occult army, especially with a lot of the other deep striking aggressive threats that they can bring. He kind of ended up Well, I think that he ended up using his as a big area denial, like objective holder. But by the time I whittled away the rest of his army, I could just pick off two a turn with a number of shots, yeah. And it didn't pan out for him. Sorry, you were asking a question.
Do you think that they take the place of Aberrants as kind of a premier damage dealing unit?
I think you need both.
Yeah, I would agree. That's what I was thinking when I was kind of wondering about how you would manage those two units on the board. And, you know, as far as how far you could push this, do you think there's a way to fit a good Gene Stealer combo, Nids and Guard?
Oh, that's asking a lot. Well, he did in this list. He had a bunch of the Duranthropes and Zoanthropes. Like on paper, his list had a lot of stuff that I wasn't stoked about. I think he just didn't play it as aggressively as he could have. So I think there might be an avenue there for sure. I think it's got to kind of all come. It's going to be very swingy. Like if you need first, maybe you don't need it, but I think it'll be super helpful. And pretty much your whole army's got to be in their face by turn two. And if not, if you're just coming at them piecemeal, I think it can be an issue.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, imagine a normal Gene Stealer that crash assault wave that you catch kind of, you know, turn one or turn two. And then imagine that instead of you're shooting into things with 5-up armor saves or 6-up armor saves, you're shooting into Bulgrins with a 3-up. For your Overwatch.
Yeah, exactly. That's so much
better. I think that's kind of the magic moment there.
I agree. I thought that's what he was going to do because I wasn't sure if I was going to have an answer to that. And instead, he didn't drop his Aberrants in until turn three, and the Bulgrin stayed in the middle of the table. I think if he had thrown the Aberrants and the full tilted the Bulgrins into my face, the game would have looked super different.
Alex, let's go ahead and talk about your knights. I mean, let's just keep going on that. How would you, how confident are you dealing with a big 8 block of Bulgrins backed up by, what are they called? The hammer aberrants, especially from the anointed throng?
Great question. There's only so much you can do when they come from the shadows. So part of it is dice rolls. If they fail their, if they don't get their 6 and they fail their 9-inch charge, well, no matter what, they're kind of SOL because then they have to deal with my shooting and my charges. Mm-hmm. So that's not going to be a good day for them. How many wounds are aberrants?
They're 3, I want to say, but there might be 2, but I believe so. The bigger issue is they always reduce damage by 1. So if you're shooting 2 damage weapons,
and they have a solid feel no pain, if I remember correctly,
too.
You have
to buff them specifically.
Yeah. You have to buff them with feel no pain.
The fact that they're taking they turn damage 2 into damage 1 is huge. Damage 3 becomes damage 2, so that. Your ability to whittle them away with multi-damage weapons, the efficiency of it dramatically reduces very quickly.
That is very true. I would be curious to see how my army would end up turning out because the combat phase would be incredibly important for both armies. The fact that I will always have more stomps than a loyalist knight would probably put some concern on the player. I mean, the Bulgrin's got an invul. So they don't have to worry as much. But, every single one of my Titanic units have a minimum of 15 stomps at AP3 rather than AP2. So
that's so gross. Awesome. That's so gross.
I love that so much.
It's the old river. It is literally the old river dance joke from when Knights got released.
Yeah. So, you know, it'd be curious to see how it all ended up, but really the Bulgrins would probably be the worst thing, but still, you know, you can tear up the sides, hit them on the angles, and then, you know, not all of them might, you know, get into combat. So you can be smart about and play cagey with your knights, and things might be able to work out for you. But I don't know. You know, it's a rough sell. It really depends on terrain too, going with what we were talking about a little earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I'm just more interested to see how things end up with knights, or I mean with space marines, specifically Iron Hands. Like, I want to fight against a pure space marine vehicle army and just like see what happens. I'll probably get wrecked.
I was just thinking, like, you're excited by that matchup?
I mean, it's good to fight the hard stuff first when you're list building and practicing, because you know, you always want to train in the harder situations than you have to fight in.
Exactly.
I mean, I think probably if it were me, I'd just have burned down my list already and started rebuilding with what I know they can do to me. You know, it's like, do I really need to run into a brick wall head first to find out if it's going to hurt?
Fair enough.
I mean, sometimes.
Well, that's absolutely true. As we said, there were a whole lot of rule changes coming out in the last couple days. Between the ITC and Games Workshop, the two biggest ones I would argue are the changes to the vehicle fly rule that are now that I guess were tested at another event, and now they're official for SoCal. Is that how it is?
I don't know about testing another event, but I think they're going to be using them at SoCal, is my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
They will be using it at SoCal now. For those who aren't aware of this, the change is going to be several days old, so it shouldn't be too much of a surprise. But if you are a fly keyword vehicle and you want to go above the first level of a ruin or a building or a piece of terrain, you need to make sure that your 100% of your hull is covering that.
Unless you have a base.
Or is on that
piece. Then the base has to be full.
Yeah, which means the whole base has to fit.
Yeah, but it also has to be a vehicle that lacks the hover rule, because there are vehicles like Necrons, for instance, that have a base but also have the hover tank rule. Same with, you know, Eldar flyers or Eldar tanks, for example. But Repulsors have bases.
Yes, Repulsors do have bases. They have extremely large, spindly ones that I don't quite understand how they don't break every time people look at them wrong.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever seen an actual what it comes with stand on one of those.
Sure do wish that Games Workshop made a basing required basing document.
That'd be
for
weird.
40K.
You're asking a lot of them, man. They've turned around. Things are good.
Yeah.
I mean,
hold on.
Come on,
Ben. They have that for
no.
Other systems.
That's not. We're not talking about consistency here.
Yeah, but it's not a hard. It's not like a crazy
thing
to pull off.
No, I'm absolutely in agreement with you. I'm just being a jackass, which is so unlikely.
But hey, the Caladius doesn't
have one.
It does
have a base, but it specifically has a rule that all distances are measured to and from the hull.
Yeah, the hover tank rule.
Yeah, but then I was like, well, if I'm always measuring to and from the hull, I'm never going to use this base. So. I'm sure maybe somewhere I have the bases still, but I don't use them in game.
Good strategy. Just don't bring the base.
So I think kind of we all can sort of infer who's going to be hurt the most by this. It starts with E, ends with R, and can also be translated as fuck you. I have no sympathy for most of the people affected by this rule change.
Yeah,
honestly.
I mean, I would say, in addition to our fine pointy-eared friends, I know I've definitely used the fly rule to save my tanks before. I think Custodes players have something definitely to take into consideration. So it definitely makes Power Fist Telemans look a little more interesting. just so they can fight their way out of stuff instead of now flying. I don't know. There's many situations where I've used the top story to save my tanks. You know, I think, you know, for the health of the game, it's going to be good. I'm not going to act like it probably won't lead to more balanced situation, and shooting armies definitely didn't need any more help, especially at avoiding terrain. But I won't act like I personally am not a little bit like, ah, crap.
Yeah, I got in. Alex mentioned this in our group chat, or somebody mentioned this in our group chat earlier. I had a little bit of a moment a few years ago where I deployed a bunch of vehicles on the third story of one of the big manufactorum terrain pieces. I don't know if you remember those that were like 8 or 10 inches tall. And my opponent literally looked at the judge and said, "How am I supposed to interact with this?" And I said, "Hey, man, just shoot it. It's still legal."
Well, and this was like the thing, like according to the RAW, it's still okay to, at one point was okay to set them up that way. Just when they move, they have to always end their movement on the bottom floor.
Yeah.
So there's definitely,
and there wasn't still really
moments where I've seen people do that.
Yeah.
I mean, if I don't move, I don't have to end my move on the bottom floor.
You just have to be able to deploy up there.
So it's that meme of the guy tapping the side of his head. It's like, if I don't move, but yeah, this seems like the kind of thing where you're restricting. I don't see how this is anything but good for the game. It was a little ridiculous to see some of the shenanigans that were popping up with where people were putting flyers, and now you can't do that. And it does kind of make them easier to block off the board, which is kind of entertaining.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see if I think if there's a situation where we see a plethora of it becoming a problem, I would be okay with them trying to find some balance. Honestly, I still think if you have like supersonic or something like that, real fly, you should still be able to land on those roofs because, like, you're actually flying, right? You're not, like, hovering.
Yeah.
But that's not that flyer plane armies needed any more help, but just, I don't know. There's kind of these weird things, right? What arbitrarily bugs us on rules corrections or not, and being like, well, you know, you're screwing my army or whatever. It's like, you know what, man? Like, it happens to everybody. Like, at some point or another, it's going to rotate around. And something's going to happen that's going to jack with you a little bit. And you can scream into the wind and everyone will really care about your opinion. Or you can just change your army.
Yeah. Or it just, you know, make some basic modifications and change just a little bit how you play. And then you'll be over it and it'll be behind you and you'll probably realize you were overreacting a shitload.
Oh, and well, and they're in the September FAQ, but the Gene Stealer cult changes.
We're just going to read out the following the paragraph that they added along to it, and then we'll kind of talk about what it means. Any unit set up underground in this way cannot arrive on the battlefield during the first battle round, and in a matched play game, which is most of what we talk about here, if they haven't arrived by the end of the third round, they count as destroyed. So they finally do obey the same rules as all other reserves. That's kind of a brutal hit to the Codex. I'm not going to lie.
Well, it really seems like Games Workshop's really trying to standardize reserve rules. Like, there's just not unique approaches to interacting with reserves and coming in from them for almost anybody, for, like, anything. And the only way you can get that uniqueness is maybe through stratagems.
Yeah, I understand the point that, you know, you want to remove as much possible imbalance from a game, but at the cost of removing like the unique flavor of a faction, I'm not sure it's worth it. Gene Stealer Cult weren't broken being able to drop their whole army on you first turn. You know, like it was just, that was what they did, was 5 or 6 units just show up right in your face, above 9 inches away. And it's like, hey bro, I hope your Overwatch is hot, or you better hope I fail this charge. And now that it just seems, it feels like an unnecessary nerf. And I don't know how this is supposed to – I don't know who this is for, I guess is kind of what I'm asking. Like, Ben, you were pretty honest about your appraisal of the balance between shooting and assault. We all know that's true. This is a shooting-heavy meta probably as long as 8th edition exists the way it does. So nerfing an assault army like this just kind of feels, you know, piling on.
Yeah, my guess is that some GW staff guy happened to look over at the wrong moment, that the one time the Gene Stoller cult player had his one in every 30 games where everything goes magically right. And the Games Workshop guy was like, oh my God, what have we done? And they've no concept. They're like, this is at a tournament. This must happen all the time. And, you know, that's my only reason that they might think this happened. Or a couple of TO game testers they trust said, you know, oh, this has happened to my buddy 4 times and it's a problem. I don't know. I mean, that's pure speculation, but I just can't think of anything more logical besides the fact that they're really trying to standardize reserve interactions so there's fewer gotcha moments.
Alex, weigh in here. I mean, give us what's your take on this?
You know, I still have PTSD from 7th edition from GSC. So part of me just wants to be like, fuck them. I don't care. Before the ruling became official, I actually disagreed with this ruling, as our listeners may historically remember. But now that it is, you know, it's official, we just got to live with it. I agree. I think that it's not something that was needed, like Ben said, but maybe there was a playtester moment where it just was like, holy shit. Like, you know, just the dice went Super Saiyan, and the guy went wild. I think it hurts them, which sucks. It just gives them one less tool in the toolbox, and they're not in the best place right now. I mean, they'll still, you know, that's the, how do we equate this? Gene Stealer cult are the army that, you know, in a street fight, it's like the person who won't be able to win, but if they can hit you in the nuts first and like get you down, they win. And if they don't, they're going to get the shit kicked out of them.
Yeah.
And that's how I think of Gene Stealer cult. They either hit you hard and they win, or they're just going to get fucking demolished for the most part. Now, that's not.
Do you guys know of any events that they've won?
Nova.
Just Nova, right?
Was it Nova Richard?
Nova Invite. Yeah, okay. which also, in the hands of a good player, though, you can be super cagey and you can actually use that stratagem in the first 3 turns instead. And you have a lot more flexibility to try to, you know, I think that normally people will try to just hit you turn 1 and then either win or lose right there. But I think that a smart player will be able to kind of, you know, try to bait the opponent, try to stagger their units a little bit, especially through redeploy. So there's a lot there, but I think you kind of got to go pure Gene Stealer cult with this one.
I feel like the idea behind that codex was kind of I'm going to go with the puppet master, where, you know, you have kind of the dude, he's kind of sitting back behind all of his units in different places all over the board, kind of picking you apart, and kind of you lose this unit and all of a sudden, oh no, I'm exposed here and I reposition. Then you lose that unit. Oh no, I've lost that one. Now I have to reposition. And then at a certain point, you just get swarmed, and they don't really function that way. And unfortunately, because they're pretty much just a, we have to knock you out with our first charge list. They can be kind of a negative a phrase that we use in X-Wing is negative play experience, where just the game kind of swings on a coin flip. And I think maybe this is meant to maybe force Gene Stealer cult players to play more conventionally. But like I said, I don't know if that's good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty well put, actually, a good summarization of their situation, because that's like the whole point of the army is that it's not conventional, right? It's like a rebellion.
Yeah, they're asymmetric.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, when you're that kind of, I'm going to equate orcs and Gene Slayer Cold a little bit. They both kind of have a critical mass moment where they have a number of units on the board where they're a threat, and then they don't, and they're no longer really offensive. They're no longer able to impact the outcome of the game. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this doesn't do anything to fix that problem. All you've done is make it a lot easier for somebody to chip away at them before they can do any damage.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that.
I don't like this rule. I don't think it was needed. And I don't think anybody, even the people who probably dislike playing against Gene Stealer Cult, they probably will realize that all this did was nerf them even further unnecessarily. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sad day for the Gene Stealer Cult players. We didn't do it, and we don't agree with it. We wish you the very best of luck.
Yeah, I think the good ones will still adapt and overcome, like we were talking about earlier. But, I mean, I don't think the army's worthless. I definitely think it's, to me, though, it doesn't really seem that popular as it once was.
No, it's not.
Let's go ahead and wrap the show up. Ben, thank you very much for joining us for the first time, and we look forward to bringing you back at the next opportunity.
I had a great time. Thanks so much for having me and talking nerd stuff.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure, sir. And Alex, go ahead and sign off.
Yep. Everyone have a good night.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. We hope you enjoyed this little conversation about Gene Stealer Cult getting kicked in the nuts and about Eldar getting kicked in the nuts, which we all enjoy. And we'll talk to you next week.
Winning is not a sometime thing. It's an all the time. You don't win once in a while, and you don't do things right once in a while. You do them right all the time. Winning is a habit.